When were Palestinians born? What was all this area before the First World War? When Britain got the mandate over Palestine, what was Palestine then? Palestine was then the area between the Mediterranean and the Iraqi border.
You say there is no such thing
as
Palestine.
East and West Bank, no. East and West Bank was Palestine. I'm a Palestinian. From 21 until 48, I carried a Palestinian passport.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Sunday, May 9th, 2021. Thank you for joining me today. We have a special edition of the Daily Wrap-Up for you today that is going to be entirely focused on actually what we used to focus primarily on before COVID clown world began, which is U.S. foreign policy, more particularly U.S. foreign policy and its allies and what's happening in the larger agenda around that. But specifically within that topic today, we're going to talk about what all of you hopefully have been aware of if you're paying attention, which is that there is basically a third intifada that has begun inside of occupied Palestine. And this is something that Robert Inlakesh has been covering extensively, they've been writing for in The Last American Vagabond, but that deserves all of your attention. We're going to talk about this today. And I'm right there with many of you. There's a lot of this that I probably haven't been aware of, that I've been following Robert's work and haven't been doing my own investigation because we've been focusing on other things. So it's today we are going to only focus on this and let you know what's really going on there and what it really means. And also from my perspective, that it clearly links with the larger things that are happening today in its own way. So first, welcoming to the show for the third time is Robert Inlakesh. Thank you for joining me today, brother. How are you?
Great, and thank you for having me. It's a really important topic, so I'm ready to get into it.
Yeah, it really is, and it's just, I mean, for someone, I can't even imagine for someone like yourself, but for me, I've been covering this probably extensively for so years at the very least, and to see what's happening today, and to actually be like shocked by what opening fire inside of a mosque and these things that are huge that nobody is talking about in the mainstream media. It kind of blows you away. I mean, it doesn't surprise you because we all know that they're constantly lying, but to see so flagrantly, like that they can just ignore it, not talk about it, you know, and or to see things like we talked about, like we opened the show with today. Like, actually, before I even get into that, you made a really excellent point in one of your articles that I was actually talking about today with somebody, the recent one you wrote about, when we'll talk about this probably today as well, that basically Netanyahu is doing what he's accused of, even by the Israeli media all the time, which is either creating a war or conflict in some way to help himself politically, which is not that new in U.S. government or anywhere else. But you made a really interesting point about this weird lens that Americans and a lot of people in the West have in regard to what's happening here, that if it happened the same way in their at home, they would see it quite differently. And the point you made was, imagine for a moment, you set the table by saying that right now, most Jewish Israelis do not want Arabs in any way, shape or form in the government, despite having the Arab, coalition or the Arab
joint list.
These are political entities, and these are people, and they're pretty prominent. But the reality is, to compare that to the US, let's say, as you pointed out, or England, or excuse me, the UK, it's to say that imagine that you had white politicians in the US or the UK that are saying, we don't think black people should be allowed to be in politics. Everybody listening right now just went, oh yeah, that's no, right? That's not okay. And that's exactly what's happening in Israel. And it's amazing that we can't recognize, or we choose not to, that that's the same thing. Right. So my point in showing the Golda Meir clip in the beginning is to just recognize that there are people right now, and I have an example of it, of people arguing that there was never a Palestine, arguing that it's such obvious and easily verifiable lies that have been circulating in this circle, in this community forever. And it's very clearly a lie. So, you know, first off, just what are your thoughts on that in general? And there's probably a lot of those things that you would probably point out that people would still think were real. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, according to the recent polls, the most recent and authoritative polls that we have, it's around 29% of Israel's Jewish population, which believes that Arabs or that the Palestinians, they call them Arab citizens of Israel and Arab parties, that they that Arabs should be ministers or that they should be part of a coalition government, which is really crazy if you think about it. That level of racism exists, that only 29% of Jewish Israelis would support that. So it speaks to the propaganda that's, you know, pushed down their throats every single day, that this amount of a population would believe something like this, that they could not have a certain ethnicity inside of their government for whatever reason, makes it a bad thing because there's a separate ethnicity inside of their government. And on top of that, the point that you pulled up and you played that Golda Meir clip, people who are claiming that Palestine never existed or it doesn't exist, these are arguments of people that have already lost the debate. And they're pulling up things which are clearly just ridiculous points. They have nothing to do with what's going on now. And if that's your only response, then you've lost the debate already. And there's no point you even being in the debate. What Golda Meir said in that clip is that you have the East and West Bank. So she's essentially saying that Palestine was the area of what is now Jordan and also what is historic Palestine, like the primary part of Palestine. Right. And that's what she was referring to, trying to make that argument. And of course, many will try and say, quoting the old Joan Peters book, which was a fraud, trying to claim that Palestinians didn't live in Palestine and they just all flocked to the country. And she messed with numbers, Joan Peters, in her book. I think it's called From Time Immemorial. Norman Finkelstein was the one that was credited with debunking this fraud of a book which came out. And it's still sold today, this book. So it's an insult to anyone's intelligence to argue that Palestine doesn't exist or that the Palestinian people don't exist. They clearly exist. They're clearly a people. They clearly have a culture. They clearly have a history. And even the terminology, the term Palestine itself, has roots going back 4,000 years.
And these
Herodotus refer to Palestine.
And the point is, these things are easily verifiable. It's a choice to not care to look because you want to believe a certain thing. And I should have said this in the beginning, for those that don't know, Golda Meir is one of the founding members of Israel and one of the earliest prime ministers, if I remember correctly. And it's just crazy for me to think that somebody would take the word, like you're going to act like you're going to ignore what she says and listen to some writer that covered the topic. It's literally one of the people involved with the foundation of this saying that there was a Palestine. That should end the discussion. You know. So anyway, the point on that in general is that there's a lot happening, a lot of information flying around even today, that at the very least, if we know that that was a lie and people like Netanyahu himself have continued to argue that that never existed, we need to realize there's a hell of a lot more they're saying that's also not only just dishonest, but flat out incorrect. Like they're lying to you for an agenda. And so, and that thing, it's not unique to Israel's government. Our government does it. The UK government does it, but recognize that it is happening. So on that note, what is ultimately happening today? Because as following your work so far, you were one of the earliest people that I saw that were pointing to this before it was starting and saying, this is building. Like right now, the attack on the I forget the name of the town, you know, where you had the Lahava group that basically went in there with their signs, this racist Jewish supremacist group, which is what even the Israeli government calls them, going in there and beating people up and attacking these settlers, right? And so this build and build and build, and now we're seeing something actually kick off. And I believe this had to do specifically with the actions in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So what you can start anywhere you want, what you think is relevant, you know, where did this start and where are we now and why is this important?
So this has been building throughout Ramadan. And so what you just referred to there, the Lahava group, the settler, right-wing extremist fascist settler group who came out onto the streets a few weeks ago, who were chanting death to Arabs and were talking about burning down Arab villages and all these different chants that they had, clearly racist. And they were condemned by the mainstream Western press, actually. And that sort of escalated tensions at that point. But that's not where it all started, of course. And this was in the heart of Jerusalem, near the old city that this demonstration had taken place, around 1,000 of these extremist settlers. And so, first of all, what I'd like to do is analyze just that event, and we can go back to the beginning of Ramadan when this whole entire escalation started, really, because it's been going on for the entire month. It's not been something that just happened yesterday, like the mainstream press would like to report, and just random clashes. Or as, for instance, the Independent or the Not-So-Independent put it in one of their headlines, that 200 Palestinians had been injured in clashes with Israeli police at mosque. And that's what they're saying happened on Friday. So to go back to what happened with that extremist settler group, which had been described by the likes of Dan Cohen, journalist, as a lynch mob, as a modern day lynch mob, that group in of itself there, they have links or its leader, that group's leader, has direct links and is a close ally of a man named Itamar Ben-Gvir, who heads up Otzma Yehudit, that translates as the Jewish Power Party. Now, Itamar Ben-Gvir is actually in the Israeli government. Now, previously, Otzma Yehudit was banned from the Israeli government because it was too extreme. Itamar Ben-Gvir is a man who had been convicted of inciting racism. So he's literally somebody who's, you know, a racist criminal and convicted in Israeli courts of inciting racism. He is in the Knesset in a group called the Zionist Religious Zionism, or the Religious Zionism Slate. That's headed up by a man called Bezalel Smotrich. This figure, racist figure, had argued for legislation to be passed through the Knesset so that they would have segregated maternity wards in Israel, so that essentially Jewish women would not have to give birth in the presence of Arabs. That's how incredibly racist this is. So
people need to, that kind of a thing, right? This is the kind of point we made in the very beginning. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we just need to make sure that this is inherently racist by the very definition of the word. There's no other justification for that. There's not some narrative about, you know, Palestinians attacking people inside of the nurse in the maternity wards, or, like, you know, at the very least, they make this argument elsewhere. This is simply because they do not want to be around somebody. I mean, arguably a lot of other people, but specifically Palestinians. And that's just insulting, especially from a government, whether it were the UK or the United States, that are openly right now they're waging some war on racism, or, you know, this big effort, and their chief ally is one of the most racist governments on the planet, in my opinion. It's ridiculous. Please continue.
I mean, even with this, the Israeli government for a long time has, of course, it's run an apartheid regime. And that's now been accepted by Human Rights Watch. That's now been accepted by Israel's top human rights organization, B'Tselem, that it runs an apartheid regime, not just in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, but in the entirety of the country. It's one system between the river and the sea. And it's an apartheid system. But these elements, which are now in government, and of course are connected to these hardcore right-wing extremist settlers, which we saw chanting death to Arabs, they once were outlawed and now are part of the government. And in fact, Netanyahu is heavily relying upon these extremists. Right. So these are openly racist, openly religious zealots, essentially, which have quite a bit of sway with Netanyahu because he's using them to keep himself alive politically. He still wasn't able to form a government, and that has been passed on to the anti-Netanyahu bloc. Yair Lapid was asked to form a coalition, but now it looks like Netanyahu is not backing down from his support of the religious Zionism slate. And so when we're analyzing this and looking at it, we have to understand that extremist group of settlers who tomorrow are going to try and raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, and God knows what is going to happen, and the Israeli forces, occupation forces in Jerusalem are going to facilitate that, we're hearing, and they're preventing Palestinians from entering the old city so that they cannot defend their holy site. This is the third holiest site in Islam for Muslims, and this is during Ramadan, so right. The holy month for Muslims. That's the level of incitement.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because you and I mentioned, we're discussing this earlier, and I think it's really important for Americans and plenty of others to understand how important that is. As you and I were discussing, you would consider it in the same light as people in invading and attacking and hurting people inside the Vatican, right? That's the level of importance here. So if you're a Christian out there and you think about people raiding inside the Vatican and beating Christians up inside the area and having no repercussions for for it. That's what's happening right now, right? So can you touch on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and just, you know, just briefly talk about why that's important, and then maybe some of the, you know, the narratives around this, like the what Jewish Israelis believe they want to happen there, and why that's important to what we think has see happening now.
Well, this incident specifically, this was directly an incitement to violence by the Israelis. They knew this was going to escalate the Israeli government. And Netanyahu, I believe, is behind this entire push to be more aggressive. He could have easily called off the troops. But what he did on Friday night is, or what the Israeli occupation police did on Friday night, is that they decided in their hundreds to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and fire tear gas and rubber bullets into Palestinians praying whilst they were praying during Ramadan, which is the holy month for Muslims, right? In the third holiest site to Muslims and the most significant holy site in all of the land of Palestine, Israel, right? So when we're looking at this, we have to understand that this was really a racist Islamophobic attack. This was an attack which was meant to incite more violence. And they injured 200 Palestinians around Jerusalem as a result of this. They attacked medical clinics inside of the Al-Aqsa compound. They, the Israeli forces were, according to eyewitnesses, not only smashing the windows of the mosque, firing inside of mosques, but on top of that as well, they were stepping on Qurans. So the holy book for Muslims. That's what happened here. But you have the disgraceful reporting, which would paint this as some sort of equal clash, which occurred when it was an attack. It was a blatant attack. This could have been avoided. This was decided by the Israeli authorities that they would do this and stoke these tensions.
And what's important as well is that, again, the media representation, right? I mean, there's plenty of evidence to show that this is not some kind of a clash between sides. This is an open attack there's people just in the mosque worshiping. And yet they will report it as literally the opposite of that and not even care that we can show the video that proves that they're wrong. You know, this is, again, speaking to that beginning discussion point, think of the power, the propaganda manipulation, the level of effort that takes to create a worldwide misrepresentation such as Palestine didn't exist. You know, that takes cooperation amongst multiple governments. And, you know, it's so the same kind of idea. They know that they have that kind of power. They just don't care that we see it. It's just these are, in my opinion, sinister people. There's no way you can see that any other way. There's no way you could argue they think they're doing a greater good here. You know what I mean? These people to them are lesser than, and they openly speak about that. I've played that many times as well. So go ahead.
If we look specifically at this, what we're seeing on screen here, right? The attack, this is inside one of the mosques on the compound, right? Why is this in any way justifiable? And where else would it be justifiable? Who would accept this? What people would accept this? What group would accept this? Nobody. This is an attack on innocent people who are unarmed in a holy site on a holy month. So if we were to compare this, like you said, with the Vatican analysis there, if you were to compare it to, for instance, with Christians, right? If this happened at the Vatican, that some police forces, right, came in, and they're from another religion, right, and they came in and they started shooting people and firing tear gas at people whilst they were praying on Christmas, right, in the Vatican.
Right.
That's the sort of incident that this was, and it's not been reported as such. This was really, you know, you could argue this was a terrorist attack.
Right.
I mean,
let's not mince words here. I mean, the first thing you said as well is important, because it's important to recognize that it's another ethnicity doing this. So, for instance, I mean, this is the same because of all the propaganda being worked up by our government, making, you know, for all the years now, there's plenty of Americans that if you said Muslims raided a Christian church, they would lose their minds. Right. And so the point is the same thing here. Of course, this is, you know, and it's important before we even say that to recognize we're not using that term in the political sense. We're the definition of the word. An act of violence with the ends of achieving a political goal. That is what terrorism is. That's terrorism. You know, it's exactly what it is. It's just funny that they try to misrepresent these things today and bend them to meet their own desires. You know, I mean, so let me ask you this then. What are they even saying about this that justifies this? What is their argument that this is like acceptable in any way?
Well, they would say and claim, this is what I've seen by the mainstream press, that in Israel, I mean, it's in the Israeli press, I haven't actually seen them try and place too many justifications in the front of this, to be completely just fair with you.
Quiet, right? Keep it.
They're just sort of quiet. It happened. Right. It's an escalation. And it's more concern about what the Palestinians are doing in reaction to this now. And so what we've seen, and like I said, there's a big context behind this. On the first day of Ramadan, the Israeli forces had raided the site, not violently like this, but they shut off loudspeakers. And the reason why they did that, or they said the reason why they did that, was not to disturb a service ongoing for occupation soldiers who had been killed at the nearby Western Wall. Right. So basically, they didn't, you know, Jewish Israelis didn't want to have to hear Palestinians, the call to prayer, for instance, or the imams later on in the night. It would disturb them too much. And it's not like they consulted the Palestinians. They just did this because they decided to do it. Then on top of that, they placed barriers at an area called the Damascus Gate or Bab al-Amud, it's an entrance to the old city. And through the Damascus Gate, then you have the sort of the Arab quarter, as they call it, inside of the old city, where Palestinian businesses and homes are. They basically barricaded it off, placed these barricades around, restricted who could come into the old city, who could go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and were messing with people. So from the very first day of Ramadan, Palestinians ended up going into what were called clashes, right? You know, reacting to the Israelis protesting, and then the Israeli forces would bring in their riot police on horseback, the water cannons, the skunk water cannons, use their tear gas, use their rubber bullets, and even live ammunition in some cases was reported too, and just beat the hell out of everyone. And then on top of that, we have the ongoing case right now of Sheikh Jarrah, which is a village inside of East Jerusalem, and in the case of Sheikh Jarrah, the Israelis are attempting to ethnically cleanse 28 Palestinian families from the area, amounting to 550 people. They want to take these homes, and they want to essentially evict the Palestinians and allow for illegal Israeli settlers to take their places.
Gosh,
what we've seen happening.
Let's touch on that general discussion for a minute as well. The idea of this is really important, especially to give it a little plug in reference to your amazing documentary, The Steal of the Century. It's funny how we just forgot about that, right? That just never happened. At least basically that was a fraud from the beginning, which was your point of the documentary. And then we all saw that immediately. Netanyahu did whatever he wanted and claimed it was their fault. And so now we're at a point in the same way that you're talking. I mean, it's right now they are violating that in every possible way. And that doesn't even the deal itself understand, but that doesn't even discuss the legal standing in general that the UN has always maintained is a crime. These are illegal occupiers that are continuing to displace people for multiple times in a row. You know, like, can you touch on that in general? I mean, maybe just the idea of why that's illegal. And again, what baffles me about this constant ongoing discussion is that we all know this. The UN has always maintained this is an illegal occupation, right? So it's just amazing. So this means our governments are complicit. They're going along with the crimes, you know? So go into the settler part for me and what you think about it.
Well, if we look specifically East Jerusalem, because of course this is the issue, you've got, of course, around 200,000 illegal Israeli settlers, which are inside of East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem, according to the original partition plan of Palestine, which was put forth, UN Resolution 181, which was a non-binding resolution in the General Assembly. And actually, when Israel was introduced to the international community, when it was accepted as a member nation of the United Nations in 1949, this was one of the documents which was put forth that they should abide by along with UN Resolution 194, which was the right of the return for the Palestinians, in order for them to, you know, maintain themselves as a state. So the Israelis in 1948, they'd invaded the area of Jerusalem. Under the partition plan, this was supposed to be an autonomous zone. It's not supposed to belong to anyone. It's supposed to be UN monitored. They invaded into it. And as a result of this and the battles that ensued in what they called a war on Israel, but the Arab armies never invaded the territory, which according to the partition plan Israel was supposed to be in anyway. So it wasn't a war and an attack on Israel. It never happened like that. Jordan had come in and taken the other half of Jerusalem. Okay. So East Jerusalem. And during this time, The Jordanians had facilitated Palestinians, of course, moving into some areas after they've been ethnically cleansed from different areas in Palestine. And so when we're looking at the occupation, in 1967, the Israelis illegally occupied East Jerusalem, along with the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, and also the Golan Heights. So for East Jerusalem, when that was occupied, that's never been recognized as Israeli territory. And according to all of the like the Oslo Accords, etc., and the international consensus, this is to be the capital of a future Palestinian state. And so when Israel annexed, de jure annexed the territory in 1980, this was never recognized by the international community. But in 1980, it could apply its own law. That's what it did it for. It applies Israeli law inside of East Jerusalem. And it also expanded that territory. But there was one big problem for them, is that the Palestinians were still living there. So they had legislation in place from the 1970s, which would create an ethnic balance. Now, the ethnic balance was not 50-50. It was 26% Palestinians and the rest Jewish people in the area. So how do you stop, you know, Palestinians from being the majority in East Jerusalem? Well, you ethnically cleanse them. And of course, there's a number of different racist laws which are used for Israel to place its settlers in there. But you have to understand that Israel views this as part of Israel. It does not view this as part of anywhere else. And right. They see what they're doing is perfectly legal. They say, well, this is, we annexed it, it's ours. And the international community says no. And they say these are illegal settlers. But to Israel, these are just normal Israeli citizens living in Israel. That's what they view it as in their undivided capital, which is literally divided by an apartheid wall.
Right.
Is, you know, it's just
laughable. It makes you like your stomach turned. Think about how long. So you're talking about even back in the 80s, even though these are actions that were openly illegal, internationally speaking, in any way you want to frame it. So nothing happened, right? It's amazing that we can pretend like this is not the case when the history is quite clear. Why didn't the international community do anything? Why didn't the U.S. government do anything? There's not even a question about, let me ask you this, in Israeli government's perspective, do they point, is that an illegal act that they committed? What's their justification for what happened in 1980?
In 1980, that's a decision they made to do a de jure annexation. So last year, for instance, Netanyahu had promised in his election campaign that if he became prime minister, he would annex, or what he would, as he termed it, establish Israeli sovereignty over the Jordan Valley inside of the West Bank.
Which is a crime.
Yeah.
Right. And no one disagrees with that, the United Nations. And these are openly stated. I'm going to commit these crimes because I just don't think they're illegal. Like this is almost juvenile. You know what I mean? Like it's incredible that, and this again, just to make the same point, is because our governments allow it, period.
And it's utter insanity. If you look what they're doing now, the most pertinent issue, I think, the one that's the most important at the moment, is the case of Sheikh Jarrah. So the people of Sheikh Jarrah, Israel orders, and it says that these people in Sheikh Jarrah don't have proof that they've been living like in these properties, right? That the paperwork wasn't done under Jordanian rule, and that these homes or the area used to be owned by Jews. And so according to Israel's 1950 absentees property law, and they use this, by the way, it's well documented in the Human Rights Watch report. If anyone wants to go through the 220 plus page report there,
I'll include it.
It's well documented how this absentees property law was used to annex Palestinian territory, going back to the law's inception. But now they use this in East Jerusalem, along with a decision made in the Knesset in 1977 in order to say this land that used to belong to Jewish people can be returned to Jewish people. But there's no such thing for Palestinians on the other side. So Palestinians can't claim land. The people of Sheikh Jarrah, though, these people specifically, and why the case is so incredibly ridiculous, even by the Israeli legal system standards. And we have to understand this is not just settlers coming in by themselves. This is the whole Israeli legal system, which backs them in this, right? Right. Of course. And so this situation here, the residents of Sheikh Jarrah are actually refugees in 1947 and 1948 from places like Haifa and Yaffa, which were ethnically cleansed by Israel, the Zionist gangs at the time.
So at the very least, this is the second time they've been illegally displaced.
Exactly. And then what happened with that is when they were ethnically cleansed, the Jordanian authorities, essentially in return for them, giving up their refugee status, they would be rehomed in East Jerusalem in Sheikh Jarrah. And most of the properties there were built by the Jordanians.
Right.
Now, the argument is in the Israeli courts is, oh, well, there's no proof the documentation wasn't completed, right, by the Jordanians by the time that Israel had occupied East Jerusalem in 1967. Oh, so it's not valid. And so people who have been living in these houses their entire lives are being kicked out. And it's happened before as well. This is not the first time. Right. There's illegal Israelis that are currently living in Palestinian properties there who harass Palestinians on a daily basis and are attacking Palestinians. And they're going to take over more homes. And these are not people like, for instance, it's not, some sort of story that you can paint like, oh, the ancestors of Jewish people who were living there before and they were pushed out, they're now coming back to their homes in a peaceful manner. No, it's not. It's not the ancestors of people who were once living there. It's Israeli settlers who are allowed to go in there by the settler organizations, which have claimed the property as their own and the courts have given it to them. And so the Israeli police come in, they evict these families, and then the settlers can go in. Some of the homes, they're still got their family pictures on the walls, and the Israelis just come in and throw it on the floor. This is how ridiculous this is. And then the people are homeless. Where do they go?
So to be clear on the point in regard to this specific location, so you can verify, historically speaking, that what they're saying is not true. That in fact, their homes were not, it wasn't originally Jewish homes, right? And this is the point. Wasn't there an example? Is this the right story about they are claiming there was like Jewish kings or some kind of a garden or something? Am I misremembering that story?
This is in Silwan. Silwan, they want to destroy Palestinian properties, which would displace 1,150 Palestinians, making them homeless, in order to build a garden for Israeli kings,
which I remember, because that doesn't exist, right? And this is the point: that Palestine exists, and we know that that's not true. What they're trying to say right there, this is fable, and this is what's so incredibly frustrating. But also, the point on this is that we're talking about these people, like you said, where are they going to go? They don't just have another house to move to, right? This is the house. This is what they put together after being pushed out of their original house. This is obscene, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea is that, as many people probably don't know, is that they have to, in many cases, tear down their own homes or pay for it, right? So they kick them out and then make them pay for them to demolish their home. Otherwise, they have to destroy it themselves in many cases, right? This is, this just is, there's no way an honest person could recognize this as being okay. It's just not possible. I mean, these are human beings with families and dreams and, self-determination. These just are being kicked off to the side. And if there's the only way this is acceptable, if you think they are not that they are lesser than human beings, that's it. Mm-hmm.
And that's the way Palestinians are viewed. I'm not saying every single Israeli views them this way.
In fact, for sure, that's not the case, because you've talked about in the past, there's a lot of groups, a lot of Orthodox Jewish groups that are actively fighting for the Palestinian people. It's important to point out.
Yeah. And lots of secular groups as well. Mm-hmm. But the majority of Israelis don't want to know, don't know, or know and fully support. And that's how it is. A lot of people live in La La Land. I've traveled over there many times, so I know, and speaking to people live in La La Land, and they think they can live operating this apartheid system and just pretend Palestinians aren't really there. They don't really have to communicate with them, do much, unless they're in the military and they're physically oppressing them. And they're just these terrorists who are causing problems. Gaza's a problem.
And that's one of those other big, I'm glad you said that, because I forgot it in the beginning. That's one of the other most absurd general claims, that all of them are terrorists. Every Palestinian is a terrorist. Like, there's no way you could even make that logical argument. You know what I mean? And it's verifiably untrue. So it's the same kind of a thing. But bringing this into, unless there's any other points you want to make to kind of the build up there, where is this going? Not only your predictions of where it might end, what is the driving factor here, and what are they both fighting for, and where is this ultimately going, right? And what do you think will ultimately happen here?
So there is 2 points to analyze here. And of course, on top of that, what may happen, and we can speculate over that. Tomorrow, the settlers, of course, when we're looking at what may happen, the settlers, approximately 3,000. Some people have even said their estimates up to 30,000 settlers may show up, but we don't know yet. These extremist settlers, these racist settlers, will show up and attempt to raid Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so this is going to ignite a storm inside of all of the occupied territories, the entire country. Palestinians are going to react throughout. If we're going to analyze the Israeli government's role in this and what Netanyahu is doing at the moment, he's in a position where he's backing these extremist right-wing settlers. He wants to keep them on side. Ideally, I think he wants to go for a fifth round of elections. It's the best for him because he couldn't form a coalition government. He couldn't form his cabinet. So he does not want the opposition to be able to do that. He knows that the opposition, if there is a mass uprising by Palestinians, he knows that the opposition can't form a coalition. It would go to a fifth round of elections. And so he wants to keep those right-wing settlers on side. So he's backing them. And you'll see the statements from the Israeli authorities only condemn the Palestinians for clashing with the police, as they say, and not the police violence, not the settler violence, not the settler racist, not the eviction of Palestinians from homes, for instance. They've taken a hardline stance alongside the settlers. And so at this point, the settlers, the extremist settlers, have a lot of sway over Netanyahu, and Netanyahu wants to keep them on board for his own political survival. And the question becomes, does Netanyahu care more about his own political survival than he does about Israel itself? And that brings us to the Palestinians and what the Palestinian response has been and will be. The Palestinians, their anger, their collective outrage at what's been going on has been building. And what happened in Masjid al-Aqsa with the attack by hundreds of Israeli forces on worshippers there has ignited a storm, the likes of which we have not even seen before in terms of Palestinians with Israeli passports inside of what is Israel, Israel proper as it's referred to as, have rose up. Tonight, we've seen in Haifa, in Jaffa, in Nazareth, that Palestinians are rising up. In the West Bank, they've been rising up in and even committing these desperate armed attacks, the likes of which we haven't seen in years. And then on top of that, in East Jerusalem, the people are fed up. They're absolutely fed up, and they're not having it anymore. They're not having the daily oppression, the eviction from their homes, the home demolitions, the murder of their family members, the imprisonment of their family members, the checkpoints, everything that's going on. And we could go through the list. And the Gaza Strip has now got involved, and the armed factions have now got involved as well. So the armed factions are going to give an armed response to what Israel has done from the Gaza Strip. The people in Gaza as well, there's talk of them reviving the Great Return March, which we saw start on the 30th of March 2018. And at least at night now, what we've seen is that Palestinians have been coming out to the fence during the day as well, and at night protesting against the Israelis, fearless, you know, the way that they've been protesting in order to show their collective outrage, doing whatever they can. And so we've seen throughout the territories that Palestinians are energized, that they are willing and ready to essentially sacrifice even their lives, if it means that, for their freedom in a way that we haven't seen in years. This is perhaps the best, one of the best positions that the Palestinians have been in order to extract some sort of, at least something from the Israelis, to have a better way of life that we have seen in years. Perhaps in the history of the conflict, this is one of the best moments for the Palestinians, maybe the best moment, if they take advantage of this situation and come together, all of them, because the Israeli political system is extremely divided, and not only inside Palestine, in the camps in Lebanon, the camps in Syria, the camps in Jordan, all around the world, Palestinians are outraged, and people are becoming outraged because you cannot deny what your eyes show you. Right. You know, mainstream media might say it's an optical illusion and it was a clash, but you've seen the videos. You can go watch the live streams from the very start of the events and you can see what's happening. Everyone can see Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, their report saying it's apartheid. Everyone knows that the ICC is investigating war crimes and the Israelis are rejecting it. We can all see the eyes are on, the pressure is on legally with the ICC, the pressure is on PR-wise with the human rights organizations and what they've declared, and the people around the world that have had enough and are boycotting. The Israeli political system is in turmoil. And then on top of that, as well. Israel is not making friends in the region surrounding it. It's making more conflict with Syria, with Lebanon, Hezbollah in Lebanon, with Iran, and it's going towards a conflict with Gaza. So Israel's in a bad position, and it's igniting an intifada, and it has been declared as such by some Palestinian organizations. And if tonight, tomorrow night goes extremely violently, I'm going to confidently say that this will be the third intifada, and it already looks like this has started, and it's been boiling for some time. And I can't see Palestinians being quiet at this point. It's too much what's happened to them, and the collective outrage is now reaching the mainstream, and we're seeing the reaction from Palestinians.
Yeah, quite frankly, I don't see how you can ignore and do nothing at this point. You know, this is a perfect opportunity to make sure people remember that, according to the United Nations, that's never faltered on this point, they have a right to armed rebellion. Like, this is what the mainstream media will never tell you. It's an illegal occupation. And the UN's always claimed that. And that means the people under that illegal occupation have an international right to armed rebellion. So when they say that, oh, they threw a rock, so we shot that child, it's absurd to argue that this is somehow justified, you know, even in a normal sense. But then add on the fact that they have a right to armed rebellion, I wouldn't call a rock armed rebellion. You know, what they're, you know, the idea that they have a right to fight back is just completely undermined and ignored. And there's a reason for that. Just like they lie that there wasn't a Palestine and everything else they're doing. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I don't think, at least from my perspective, I would never argue that it's a positive thing to see some kind of conflict, because people always get hurt that aren't even involved, especially when you have a government like the Israeli government that historically has been wildly, you know, what's the right word for it? Just the U.S. government does the same thing. They have the technology to be pinpoint accurate, but they choose not to be, right? It's a malicious tactic that we see all the time. And it's just, it's hard. So I ultimately hope that we don't see some kind of massive war, but at the same time, it's kind of a conflicting thought. I hope that they do what they need to do, because we continue to see these people oppressed. And I mean, how long has this been going on? When was the year that this began, in your opinion?
1947, really, in terms of the, and then 1948, Israel was created.
Just think about how long this has been going on, and how long the information has been in front of you, everybody out there watching, and it's still happening.
And even before that, really, like, I mean, there was ethnic cleansing going on before that, into the early 1900s. So into the late 1800s. So a very long
time. We have a few minutes left. Can you just speak for me on the idea of Al-Aqsa Mosque and what Jewish Israelis believe should be there, right? Because this is one of the interesting points about how there's this, you know, theory or what's the right word for it? Not myth, but I'm just blanking on the right word for it. There's prophecy. Thank you. I don't know why I couldn't remember that. This is supposed to be, you know, destroyed and rebuilt. And that seems like an interesting thing that might be driving this mentality. So just quickly on that thought for us.
Well, that's a complex issue. I mean, I can't speak for all Jews or Judaism and the many different interpretations of Judaism. I mean, plenty of Jewish people, and there's a large debate on it, would declare that you can't, and no Jewish people could ever go to the Temple Mount, right? They can't go to the Al-Aqsa compound because of the sacredness of the site. Hmm. You have, however, though, a small group. However, they have power. They have a decent amount of sway. But I don't believe they can achieve their aims because it's too much. But these, you know, temple groups, as they call them, these extremist settlers, they do believe in destroying the site and what they call re-erecting Solomon's Temple, the third temple, as they call it. And they believe this is some sort of prophecy, right? And so you have some extremist groups that believe this. However, I don't believe, even if it comes down to this sort of action, I think Netanyahu would have to drop the settlers, even at the expense of his own political career, because the destruction of this site is the destruction of Israel. It won't exist anymore after it. And I can promise that would happen. It's too much. It's over the top. It's just the most insane thing. And no, like, you know, most of the Israeli government are actually, you know, even if they, you know, do all of the traditions, like, for instance, Western politicians do, claiming to be Christian, but they're not really. They're secular. And the state in of itself is a secular one, largely. I mean, it's a racist one, and it views, you know, being Jewish as a nationality, and therefore, you know, of course, it oppresses Palestinians and other groups as well. But in terms of this hardline settler belief and whether this could ever be enacted. Unless a settler terrorist was to blow it up, I can't see it happening. And I don't think the Israeli authorities want that personally.
Yeah. What I found more interesting was just that this mentality is at the very least driving this idea of people, you know what I mean? There's some, at least to some degree, like it's interesting to see them, you know, speaking about like basically rushing into this mosque and yet at the same time, there's a prophecy that that's sort of something that needs to be destroyed. It's just an interesting way to see how this could be driving, you know, ideologically driven, which seems like an obvious point, you know?
And that is one of the dangers of this sort of settler group. For instance, tomorrow, what are they going to do in the site? Right. What are they trying to, you know, may they bring?
Right. Or what if something happens and it's blamed on the Palestinians or some kind of wayward rocket that, you know, came from somewhere where we, you know, there's a lot of these top possibilities. But the point is, it's interesting to see that. And I think that no matter what, how an honest person, as I keep saying, someone who's willing to look at this information objectively, cannot walk away thinking that what's happening is acceptable or even legal or moral or in any way, shape or form. Okay. You know, so the last point, cause I know we're like 1 minute left, just, I think is interesting. It's just one thought on this. It's pretty almost macabre humorous that of course, Israel is the first country in the world to create vaccine apartheid. I just find that to be too telling that they create a situation where there's vaccinated and unvaxxed and they are not allowed to do things and they have chairs for the vaccinated. And, you know, it screams whites only kind of a thing, just like we saw in the United States. So what are your thoughts on that to wrap this up? This, you know, it's not surprising that they would do apartheid in other ways too.
Well, for instance, what they did in the West Bank is that they said that, for instance, at the start of Ramadan, that Palestinians could not go to Al-Aqsa Mosque unless they were vaccinated, but didn't offer them vaccinations. And then, so that's the way that it stopped Palestinians from coming in. And then, of course, they're implementing all of their different strategies. And the thing about Israel is they claim that they're top of the world and they get put all over the BBC and the rest of it, that they're doing so well and that their medical innovations are wonderful and magnificent. But then look at what the situation of the Gaza Strip is at the moment.
Which is under their, I mean, this is the point. It's like people, it's an open air prison. People cannot leave. People have controlled electricity, controlled water. And so, you know, we've talked about a lot of this stuff, which is just obscene. It really is. But sorry to cut you off. I have an interview in a couple minutes, but I just, last point, someone in the chat asked, how can they help, Robert? How can people in the chat help what's going on right now?
Depends where you are in the world, but I'd say that, you know, the action that can be taken from the Western world is writing to politicians, of course, boycotting Israeli goods. People say it doesn't work, but for the Palestinian people who are suffering and dying and sacrificing their lives, if you're at a protest, they will see that. This goes to the Palestinian media and they see it and they love the fact that people are coming out and supporting them. So I say in that sense, the symbolic message to that sense, that's a very good thing as well. So, and if I can just put in one more point here, sort of to end off with, and then I'll be quiet. The situation that we're seeing now in terms of this expanding and growing into, you know, a large conflict, right, an intifada and people saying that, you know, this is a terrible thing. Well, the reason why this has happened, there's two ways to stop Israel from doing what it's doing or any rogue regime from implementing these sort of oppressive measures, economically or physically. If you can't do it economically, like the Palestinians do not have the means to, and barely they have the means physically to do it, but they are going to try because their backs are against the wall and the outside world has failed them. The international community has failed to act economically. So violently is how it has to go. So it is the fault of the international community. It is the fault of the United States government, the British government, the European Union, and others who could have changed this situation in the blink of an eye, but did not act and allowed this apartheid regime to go on. And so because they allowed Israel to commit these actions and did absolutely nothing, now the Palestinians are reacting, and who can blame them? And they have that right to armed resistance, to self-defense, and to come out in mass nonviolent protest as they are doing also. So they have those rights. This is the actions of people who have their backs against the wall and they've had enough. And they're coming out and they're making their voices be heard and they're trying to end the policies which are being, of course, practiced against them by the Israeli authorities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I appreciate you taking the time, Robert, to be here to let us know what's going on. And I'm sure you'll continue to follow up on this. So keep an eye out for his own work on at his platforms, Twitter, elsewhere, as well as in The Last American Vagabond. And, you know, to just end that with a quote, I believe it was Jefferson, but people remember it in general, that, you know, when you make peaceful revolution impossible, you make violent revolution inevitable. And that is a choice that's being made by these sinister people. So thank you for being here, brother. And also, as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
This is the defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, talking just a couple of weeks ago. Israel is going to hurt Lebanese civilians, to include kids of the family. We went through a very long discussion. We did it then. We did it in the Gaza Strip. We are going to do it in any round of hostilities in the future. That's the defense minister. This is the military chief of staff, Benny Gantz. The next round of violence will be worse and see this suffering increase. He headed up the military assaults on Gaza, the last two. This is the Minister for Education in the Netanyahu government. There will never be a peace plan with the Palestinians. I will do everything in my power to make sure they never get a state. He also said, if you catch terrorists, you simply have to kill them. I've killed a lot of Arabs in my life, and there's no problem with that. This is the Minister for Justice. Palestinians are all enemy combatants. This also includes the mothers of the martyrs. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should the physical homes in which they are, which they raised the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there. That's the Israeli Minister for Justice in the last few months. The Israeli Minister for Deputy Minister for Defence. Palestinians are beasts. They are not human. The Minister for Foreign Affairs, C.P. Hotley, this is the last one. My position is that between the sea and the Jordan River, there needs to be one state only, the State of Israel. There is no place for any agreement of any kind that discusses the concession of Israeli sovereignty over lands conquered in 1967. Now, these are the official statements of several ministers of the current government of Israel. In one case, actually advocating genocide of all Palestinians, including children, and calling them snakes. Now, can I ask you, Taoiseach, do you not think that if we're defining terrorism, that is the language and thinking of terrorists? That it is absolutely unacceptable in civilized politics, in civilized international relations, for the heads of government of a state that we carry on normal relations with and who you met in Paris to advocate those sort of views when we know they have also led on to the deaths of thousands of Palestinians, innocent men, women and children. What have you to say, Taoiseach, about those sort of views being expressed by the Israeli government?